Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So here is Mitt Romney's Etch-a-Sketch dilemma. You shake it up after the primaries, in the famous words of one of his aides, and redraw yourself in the center for the general election. But what happens when at the same time the Tea Party is pulling your party hard toward the right? Our first guest today is political reporter Robert Draper, who has a major new book about the current Tea Party-driven Congress called Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. You may remember Draper from his best-selling book about the Bush administration a few years ago called Dead Certain. Robert, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on.
Let me start here. The Republican primary voters have chosen the candidate who was derided as a Massachusetts moderate. Does that mean the Tea Party is dead as a political force?
Anything but. I think that what we've seen instead is a kind of maturation of the Tea Party. I mean, Brian, you know, people look at the diminishing size of Tea Party crowds and extrapolate from that the movement is done. But when you look at how Republicans actually behave in terms of their campaigning, in terms of how they vote, it's clear that they're reckoning on, you know, a battle with the Tea Party if they don't sort of kowtow to it. I mean, the Lugar-Murdoch race was in Indiana. The Senate race was, you know, yet another reminder of that. But, you know, you look at Mitt Romney and his embrace of the Ryan budget. I doubt we would have seen that in 2008. In fact, Paul Ryan was the ranking member of the House Budget Committee for the Republicans and proffered that very budget. And I don't recall Romney supporting it. In fact, I know that he did not. Many Republicans did not. But that's, again, how the Tea Party has influenced the dynamics of this election.
With turning Medicare into a voucher system and things
exactly.
like that. So in the news today, the lead story on Politico is about the Tea Party wing of the House being frustrated with Speaker Boehner yet again for the election season, which is a major theme of your book. And two of the new items, they're frustrated at the prospect of extending subsidized student loan rates. They want the rates to rise with the market, not be subsidized by taxpayers. And they want Boehner to hold Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify on the so-called Fast and Furious scandal, the distribution of those guns across the border in Mexico. Is this typical of the divisions of the last 2 years?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the Speaker Boehner may be temperamentally suited to being Speaker of this particular Congress, because I think almost any other man would wake up screaming every, you know, in the middle of the night, considering how little power he has over his own conference. When we talk about, you know, the Tea Party in Congress, what we're really talking about are these 87 freshmen who were elected on the Tea Party wave in the November 2010 midterm elections. And it's not just that they're sort of strong-willed, but it's the movement that they represent. And Boehner has had extreme difficulty getting them to go along. And when he's been able to do so, it's largely been because he has attached to legislation provisions that are friendly to them, such as the Keystone Pipeline for the payroll tax and such as things that will repeal certain funding aspects of Obamacare. What that means, in effect, is that though freshmen have ultimately gotten on board with a lot of Republican legislation, convincing them to do so has resulted in the legislation being dragged so far to the right that it stands no chance of being passed over in the other chamber by the Democratic-controlled Senate and signed into law by a Democratic president.
So how do you think this relates to the Romney campaign? The New York Times had an article yesterday about Romney trying to emphasize more centrist positions now in opposition to the more conservative House. Two examples it gives are supporting those same student loan subsidies and offering a Republican version of the DREAM Act to allow some children brought here illegally by their parents to become citizens if they grow up to go to college or the military. So do you see a growing tension between the Tea Party wing and Romney that could become relevant to the fall campaign?
Well, yes, there has been tension. There will be tension. But, for example, the modified DREAM Act legislation that you're referring to has been proposed by Senator Marco Rubio, who is a Tea Party sensation, and clearly is an attempt on Rubio's part as well as Governor Romney's part to appeal to Hispanics. This after Governor Romney spent most of the primaries being as far to the right as one can possibly be on that particular issue, to the right of Rick Perry, to the right of Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum. So at the same time, yes, Romney's campaign recognizes that they've got to gravitate towards the center, and they'll pick and choose where they can do so. And yet we heard at Liberty University a day or two ago, Governor Romney being very frontal in his characterization of marriage as being between a man and a woman. I mean, he is aware that, first and foremost, he's got to hang on to his base. And that's also why we've seen him, without any equivocation, support the Ryan budget. I think that he's ultimately decided that if he does any fancy footwork on that issue, it's just going to renew suspicions amongst conservatives, amongst those in the Tea Party movement, and could prove his undoing by, if nothing else, a diminishing turnout amongst his base.
Dream Act, Rubio version that Romney has now embraced. Are you familiar with that? I'm sure listeners would be interested to know how that differs from the Dream Act as the Democrats have supported it.
Only the bare bones of it. I mean, it essentially does not award citizenship to members of of the student's family who is allowed after serving time in the military to become a citizen. And I think, serving in the military is a key provision to it. So it essentially makes it more difficult for both the students that it's aimed for and for the members of their family to obtain citizenship, which were a lot of the objections that conservatives had.
So it would be if these students who are brought here illegally as children grow up to go to the military but not necessarily to college?
That actually is still being worked out, because Rubio himself, I mean, the legislation is still at a kind of pliable stage, and to make it appealing to conservatives, I think there's still going to be some shaping, in committee as well as on the floor.
You mentioned the tension between the more moderate Romney, the more conservative Romney, on display at Liberty University this weekend in his commencement speech there. I want to play a clip from that speech that really jumped out at me. And this, again, for those who don't know what Liberty University is, that was the one founded by the evangelical pastor Jerry Falwell. So Romney is trying to run back towards the center on the one hand. On the other hand, he said this to that audience about bad values being the cause of poverty.
Central to America's rise to global leadership is our Judeo-Christian tradition, with its vision of the goodness and possibilities of every human life. The power of these values, this culture, is evidenced by a recent Brookings Institution study that Senator Rick Santorum brought to my attention. For those who graduate from high school, get a job, and marry before they have their first child, the probability that they will be poor is 2%. But if those things are absent, 76% will be poor. Culture, what you believe, what you value, how you live, matters.
So at the beginning of that clip, he dismisses religions that are not Judaism or Christianity with respect to visions of goodness and possibilities of every life. And then at the end, maybe even more remarkable, he says all you need is a high school diploma, implying not a college degree to make it sufficiently in today's economy, as long as you marry, and marry a heterosexual, I guess. So politically, do you think that a lot of married couples whose families are struggling might hear that and develop doubts about whether Romney gets their plight?
Yeah, I think he's going to have a lot of trouble explaining that, because he's essentially conflated poverty with a lack of Christian values, suggesting that people in low-income groups, don't go to church or something. And you can see again what he's up to. He feels like he needs to appeal to evangelicals who've been frankly suspicious of him for years due to his being a Mormon, and as well to talk about social reforms without without trying to sound too harsh. But you know, that entire speech was a pain to social conservatives, and it's gonna be an interesting tightrope walk for Romney, who frankly, you know, has been something of a tightrope walker most of his political career, to navigate between social conservatives and the independents and moderates who may be confused and even ultimately turned off by that kind of rhetoric.
Political reporter Robert Draper, my guest. His new book about the current House of Representatives is called Do Not Ask What Good We Do. And before we leave Liberty University and that commencement address, did you see the article in the Liberty University student newspaper about Romney coming to speak that included the line from an evangelical student editorialist that said, just one problem, he's a Mormon?
Yeah.
Now, such overt religious intolerance coming from a student is one thing, though they allowed it to go into the paper's editorial. But here is Romney from the speech actually referring to his Christianity and theirs as different faiths.
People of different faiths, like yours and mine, sometimes wonder where we can meet in common purpose when there are so many differences in creed and theology. Surely the answer is that we can meet in service, in shared moral convictions about our nation, stemming from a common worldview.
So do you think Romney has that big an evangelical problem for November? People who would never vote for Obama, but staying home in swing states because they have different religions from Mitt Romney that are also Christian?
Well, it matters less what I think and what the Romney campaign thinks. I mean, it's been central to, you know, the way they've conducted their campaign that they have assiduously avoided discussion of Mormonism. This actually goes all the way back to when he first ran for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat back in 1994. Mormonism came up then, and he was uncomfortable in defending it, and a lesson that was learned from it is best not to talk about it at all. And, you know, even in that speech where he did, in a very rare instance, draw a contrast between, say, Protestants, you know, and other Judeo-Christians and the Mormon faith, he certainly didn't go on to explain what those differences were and then what their commonalities were. I mean, this is again, some footwork that the Romney campaign has decided on its own is necessary for him to do. But it's been puzzling to reporters such as myself who have noticed, you know, over the years, but certainly during this primary season, Romney's inability to connect with voters, and it has certainly seemed that a big part of that is voters have no sense of his core. They may believe that he has one, but given that he has evolved or flip-flopped on a variety of issues, and given his avoidance of talking about, say, his time in politics as governor and his faith, that they wonder, you know, if he's hiding something. They wonder who the guy really is. And you know, expounding more on the nature of his religion is, you know, to some of us, seems like a logical thing for him to do, but clearly his campaign has made the calculation that they're not going to go there.
Your book title, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, is a historical reference from another polarized Congress in 1790. You're saying they were polarized 1 year after the Constitution was adopted?
Well, they've been polarized from the beginning, and that particular quote comes from one of the first federal congressmen, Fisher Ames from Dedham, Massachusetts, who was the House's first great orator, crafted the final language of the First Amendment, and was a very active player in pretty much every major issue in the House until, after four terms, he decided not to seek a fifth term, was sick of partisan divisions, and wrote a friend in 1796 and said, "Do not ask what good we do. That is not a fair question in these days of faction." So, yes, there were divisions, but the salient point, I think, is that they managed to overcome those divisions. I mean, even as Federalists were against Anti-Federalists and Southerners were against the Northeasterners, they still managed in, you know, that first historic session to stand up a federal judiciary, the executive branch, to annex a couple of states, to pay off their war debts, and for, you know, as a final thing, to write and pass the Bill of Rights. So there were monumental things that they managed to achieve despite their many conflicts. Would that we would have as productive a session as that these days.
And, of course, they were divided, too, over that little issue known as slavery. But how does that phrase relate to today and that story relate to the Congress today?
Well, especially, as I was saying, especially because there were always partisan headaches. But with every reason, particularly back then, you know, when the United States was in fact scarcely united at all, it was in very, very frail condition, with every reason to sort of split up into factions. They united for the sake of the country. We see a lot less of that now. And I write, for example, in the prologue of my book, that just after President Obama was sworn into office, 15 Republicans gathered, largely to sort of drown their sorrows at a steakhouse in Washington known as the Caucus Room. But in the course of that evening, and I should mention that Eric Cantor was there, the majority leader, the soon-to-be majority whip, Kevin McCarthy, Newt Gingrich, the former speaker, and pollster Frank Luntz of the Republican Party, that in the course of that meeting, you know, they decided on an approach to regain power. And essentially that approach began with being united in opposition to pretty much everything that the Obama White House put up. And then with that unity, managing to develop a platform and taking back the House of Representatives, using that as a point of the spear in 2011 and 2012, and then taking back the White House. That was the language and of what they intended to do from Obama's inauguration onward. As you recall, though, we were in a deep recession then, and so rather than, you know, talking about how do we deal with this new president, how do we help get people back to work, the language was instead, you know, how do we attack, how do we fight, and how do we regain power.
So,
yeah.
So
that's
one more
long-winded way of saying that's the difference between Congress then and Congress now.
So on that note, one more story from this weekend. Because after the Tea Party candidate Richard Murdoch unseated Indiana Senator Richard Lugar, famously centrist, in a Republican primary last week, and I realized Lugar had other problems, residency and age and stuff, but the New York Times reported that the Tea Party is making a concerted effort to be more influential in the Senate with candidates this year, embracing that label in Arizona, Missouri, Texas, and Nebraska, as well as Indiana. So here is Murdoch the other day with some Tea Party brew.
I certainly think that bipartisanship ought to consist of Democrats coming to the Republican point of view. We entered this campaign wanting to be a voice and hoping to give more of a national voice to the idea that Republicans, and more specifically conservatives, would be in the majority of the United States Senate and the House, and hopefully that we have a Republican in the White House. If we do that, bipartisanship means they have to come our way.
So could the Senate, which to this day tends to be more collegial than the House, have more of the same divisions between center and right that your book is about regarding the House after this election?
Well, it could, but it's less likely. I mean, after all, you look at the performance of the Tea Party members who are running for House and contrast that with those from the Tea Party who ran for Senate, and you see that, you know, the people like Sherrin Engel in Nevada, though darlings of the Tea Party and winners in the primary, were then crushed in the general election. And so in the case of Richard Murdoch, for example, though he has this very confrontational approach that is, you know, typical of the Tea Party movement, Democrats have reacted gleefully to his having beaten Lugar in the primary. They now see that Indiana spot as being, you know, in play for them, where in the past that Senate seat had not been. So, yeah, I mean, you do see, you know, from guys like Rand Paul, who've been elected on the Tea Party wave into the Senate, evincing a confrontational approach that one more typically sees in the House of Representatives, but it's still an uphill battle for a lot of those guys to get there.
Robert Draper, political journalist, has written the book Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. Thank you so much for starting us off today.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how J.P. Morgan Chase lobbied for loopholes in the Volcker Rule that let them lose $2 billion in bad new bets in the last few weeks. Has anything changed since 2008? Stay with us.